Green, Senator Stevens, Huggins, Stedman, Lukowski, and Wagner. And today, essentially, we're scheduled for 10:30. Ran into some delays, but we're kicking off here with what is being portrayed as a topical analysis. We'll learn what topical means, I suppose, here in a bit from Mr. Mintz. And then we will proceed with Mr. Dickinson, Mr. Steve Porter, and we have Mr. Don Bullock with us here. And I don't think there are any other contributors, if you will. And with that, Mr. Mintz, it's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Mintz, and I'm with the law firm of Kirkpatrick and Lockhart Preston Gates Ellis, LLP. And I've been working with the Department of Revenue on drafting production tax legislation. Deputy Commissioner Marcia Davis intends to be here. I think she's been delayed momentarily, but I'm sure she'll be here soon. I call this presentation a topical analysis simply because I don't intend to go through in numerical order like a typical sectional analysis of a bill, but hopefully it will do the same function, and I promise you that it will be at least nearly as boring as a typical sectional analysis. Before I get into it, I'll just mention that there are quite a number of sections of the bill that only are basically conforming or technical types of amendments, so I won't be spending time addressing those, but just for the record, let me just list them off. Sections 3 to 9, 11, 12, 23, 30, 33 through 35, and 41 are considered simply conforming amendments. They often, all they do is change the paragraph number referred to. And then sections 24, 25, 29, 32, 42, 53, and 60 typically are non-substantive improvements, clarifications, or corrections in the existing language, and sometimes also conforming amendments. So with that, I'll turn to the more substantive and hopefully a little more interesting part of the presentation. Just a few background basics on the oil and gas production tax in general. This is entitled
Mr. Ford. Mr. Mintz, if I might just interrupt you for a second. Would you just bring us up to speed on when you and your organization got involved in this process?
Sure. Well, personally, until May of 2006, I was with the Department of Law in the Oil, Gas, and Mining section. And I had worked on drafting production tax legislation while in the Department of Law. And I retired on May 1st. And I had expected that the legislative process would be about done by then, but as you know, it continued in fits and spurts for some time afterward. And I joined the law firm at that time. At that time, it was Preston Gates and Ellis. I think the beginning of this calendar year, it joined with another law firm and is a bigger firm with a different name. And so as I worked with the Department of Revenue on implementing regulations after the so-called PPT Act was enacted. And then more recently, I've been working with them on drafting the new legislation.
Right. So on the when did you complete your task of the PPT regulations, or is it completed?
Well, phase one of the regulations, I think, were adopted in about March. And since then, the department has been working on phase two, but on and off, of course, because a lot of time has been taken up with the legislation.
Right. And what would you explain to us what phase one encompassed?
Okay. Well, I think phase one basically was the more urgent set of regulations that were really necessary for taxpayers to be able to calculate their taxes and fill out their returns. There were a lot of, there were some procedural issues, there were some interpretative issues that had to do with how the different parts of the bill fit together, reconciling some things that were unclear. And then phase two, which is still under development, I think one of the most important things it's going to address is giving more specific content to deductible lease expenditures. Now, as you may know, because of the fact that the initial production tax bill was retroactive to April 1st, 2006, and also because it takes time to develop implementing regulations, the legislature authorized the department to make the implementing regulations retroactive, which is kind of essential if you're going to be implementing a retroactive piece of legislation. So in that sense, as I say, the urgent stuff was basically to allow the producers to figure out how to calculate their taxes in the first instance by the deadlines. But there's some more detail that may or may not require retroactive adjustments after the regulations are adopted. However, there's nothing unusual in that. I mean, it's quite typical for producers to have to file amended returns as they get additional information that kind of relates back to the time when the initial returns were filed for.
Right. And my interest in this case on behalf of the committee is that how coherent the return factors based on the timeliness of phase one as you portrayed it for the regulations are, and how quickly you can digest that and then report. So if it was, you said at the end of March phase one was completed, what was the reporting date then?
March 31st. I think of course there's generally a 30-day lag between when regulations are filed by the lieutenant governor and when they become effective, but that meant that notwithstanding when they became effective, there was the producers had notice of what the regs were going to be. So I think that it's fair to say that they were able to implement or follow the regs in time to file their March 31st returns.
Right. But in the case, I think I heard you portray phase two as the deduction criteria, for lack of a better term, that is still, I won't put words in your mouth, I got the feeling it was ongoing.
Yes.
Is that
okay? That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So that's maturing as we sit here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah, Senator Stedman.
Maybe it's probably better for the question of the administration, but you're here representing the administration from Preston Gates, is that correct?
That's correct.
So I just piece it together, just kind of curious why the administration doesn't do their own sectional review and overview. And I recognize you know, it's a past employer relationship that you had with the state, but it just seems odd along with the presentation that was the way it was set up yesterday also at the joint committee.
Yeah, that's a good point. Matter of fact, let's stand at ease here for a couple of moments. At 12:05, and Mr. Mintz, you were progressing. We have Ms. Marcia Davis with us. Thank you, Marcia. And just to, for the public record, the reason for our delay, the chair thought it was important that we have an official administrative official here, the deputy commissioner in this case, and then, of course, Mr. Mintz, who is retained, and we appreciate so continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're just going through a few background basics to make sure everyone's on the same page when we talk about the oil and gas production tax. Title 43 of the Alaska Statutes has a number of different taxes, and the production tax is in Chapter 55. Of course, the production tax is in addition to other substantial revenue-producing mechanisms based on oil and gas. Royalties on state oil and gas leases, oil and gas property tax, and the income tax, the corporate income tax. We've had an oil and gas production tax since before statehood, I think starting in 1955. A production tax is a tax that generally imposes a percentage tax rate on some measure of the value of oil and gas produced. And of course, that's evolved over time. And it's important to remember that we're talking about the taxing authority here. It applies to oil and gas produced from land anywhere in the state, whether that's state oil and gas leases or private land or federal leases. We have to remember that's different from outer continental shelf, from offshore federal, because that's literally outside the state. We can't tax OCS oil and gas, but we can tax oil and gas from leases on onshore federal land. Just to review the core provisions of the current law, informally called PPT, because these core provisions, this basic structure has not been changed by the ACES bill. Section 011 of AS 4355 is the fundamental provision that imposes a tax, and what is taxed is what's called the production tax value of oil and gas produced in the state, and that's the taxable value, or really it's a kind of net value under the current system, and that value is determined by subtracting upstream costs, that's exploration, development, and production costs, from a value which has been an existing feature of the production tax law, which is gross value at the point of production. So you start with the gross value, which is something which has been in the law for a long time. There's a lot of settled interpretation, regs, and everything else. We don't fool with that. We start with that and then deduct the upstream costs. The PPT law introduced several categories of new tax credits in 023 and 024, and it changed the production tax from a monthly to an annual tax, but with monthly estimated tax payments. And because it's an annual tax, there's one annual return. Now, looking in a little more detail at the core provisions, the current law, that's the PPT law, has a 22.5% rate on the production tax value of the oil and gas. And in order to figure out the production tax value, we go to AS 4355-160. Here's some important exceptions to note. The tax does not apply to the state or federal royalty share. That's always been the case. And it also does not apply to the landowner's royalty share. In other words, when there's a private lease, this PPT, or percentage of net value tax, does not apply to that. There's a separate tax provision under Section 011I. The reason for the difference is because a royalty share, by definition, is a kind of gross value, and it just doesn't make sense to apply a net value tax to the royalty share. Two other important exceptions: there are tax ceilings on Cook Inlet oil and gas production, and there is a minimum tax floor on North Slope production, which under current law is a sliding percentage based on the West Coast price of ANS. Now, the current law, we just looked at 011E, which establishes a base tax rate of 22.5%. And of course, there's this so-called progressivity factor in subsection G. And under current law, that's calculated on a monthly basis when the net value of oil and gas on a BTU equivalent barrel basis exceeds $40 a barrel, then there's an increase in the tax rate by a quarter of a percentage point for each dollar that the value goes over 40. As I mentioned, gas and oil are added together using a BTU equivalent basis.
Now, Mr. Mask, if I might, given the what you just said about what this particular 2001 affects, does it address gas? What, in fact, is and will be the gas tax assuming some passage of 2001 in the form that you present, or you're presenting.
The bill does not change the treatment of gas versus oil. In general, the percentage tax, whatever it is, under either the current law or under the bill, applies to the total net value of oil and gas. Now, it's a little bit different in Cook Inlet because there are separate tax ceilings for oil and for gas, but that's not changed either.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that is my intent to ask the administration is when we are going to address that, because if one is tainted, I assume the other's tainted, if based on the rationale that I've heard about corruption and things of that nature. But no matter you know, how we describe that, that the question still remains, because our objective strategically is to do a gas pipeline, then we need to, we as both administration, Alaskans at large, and of course the legislature, needs to have a feel and an expectation of what time period we're going to make that address.
Senator Huggins, Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner. I think you raise a really good point that I hadn't thought of before, which is the contemplation of folks at home looking at this saying, well, I'm glad my legislators are taking another look at this, just even if they're going to say, we looked at it again and it's the same, or we've looked at it and, you know, based on what we've seen, we want to make some small changes or we want to make big changes, whatever the range of option is that the legislators are doing. And gas is sort of not right in our face. We're not really talking about gas, we're talking about oil. So what does it mean for gas? And because the earlier PPT law dealt with both of them at the same time, our assumption would be that as this administration or as this legislature looks at the whatever proposals are being made to do something or, you know, or look at it and do the same thing, it's still happening for gas at the same time it's happening for oil. You're looking at it. You're not being given, however, different proposals for gas. And that's a separate question, which is, we've mentioned earlier, we recognize it's an important thing we have to do, and it is something that needs to be done because there is some concern that the way PPT was passed before by treating oil and gas the same, and the way it's being approached now, which is to not carve gas out and treat it any differently than before, we still have that issue coming down the pike at us. And certainly the administration wants to address it, but our recommendation is to wait and get a little closer once we've seen what the gas proposals are, because what those proposals are going to tell us something about what types of gas projects we would be looking at needing to ensure our economic and needing to ensure that our tax system doesn't serve as a deterrent too. So there's no question that important dialogue needs to come and needs to be brought before the legislature. Our preference is to bring it after we have had a look-see at the proposals that come in at the end of November and have a sense of whether there are economic proposals and what they are, because that will inform your understanding and your debate about how you need to adjust the tax system to ensure that we as a state have done everything we can to ensure the economic viability of whatever those projects or that project might be. But I think you raise a very good point that this assurance to the public that we've looked at it is halfway there, in the sense that before PPT dealt with oil and gas the same way, we're doing the same thing here, but we recognize there's one more job to do, and right, we are putting it off to a little later date.
Right, I understand. This is event-driven, that'll be the way, and I agree 110% with you, but we know what the next event is that's going to ask the question of what are we going to do about gas, and my question that we need an answer for, I started asking this last January, put it in writing and during the spring and still don't have the answer. When are we going to address gas? I mean, we know when we're going to look at the contracts, so based on some forward planning, we should have Plan A and Plan B of when we're going to address gas. Now, I think it's important for Alaskans to understand that.
Understood.
And for the legislature.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, just to follow up on that, Marsha, are you comfortable with that? Not, I mean, if you're asking these companies to make a proposal in November, isn't it crucial to them to know what the tax is going to be? Are you comfortable with waiting until after the event, after the proposal, before we we decide what the tax should be.
Senator Stevens, we are comfortable because the application process is going to be about building a pipeline or building a line that goes, includes an LNG plant, or it may include, you know, a variety of things. And the economic viability of that is going to depend in part on, you know, what's the price of gas at the North Slope, and part of what's going to be sold. Oftentimes, majority of times, owners essentially either, they pass through that tax. And so in looking at what the tax is currently, the only statements from Commissioner Galvin on this topic have been that we are not looking to increase tax on gas. What we recognize is there actually is a sort of built-in disadvantage to gas under the system by treating it the same as oil and gas. At least our understanding of the economics now are that treating it on an economic equivalent basis, this BTU barrel basis, is not tracking market pricing, that we're going to have to give some more benefits. We're going to have to be more favorable, in other words, cutting back on how we approach tax for gas. So right now, as they look at the analysis, it would probably be a worst-case scenario as far as what they're looking at for the tax on gas, and our intention would be to look at how we make it more favorable to ensure a project goes. So they have right now, in terms of their economic modeling, what a worst case would be, but we're looking to improve that down the road. And with that said, because it's going to be pipeline companies, or at least companies wearing a pipeline hat, the lion's share of what's going to happen is going to be how economic is a project to build a pipeline. And they will take some assumptions and some givens with respect to the commodity price. Wearing your oil company hat and whether you do or don't want to sell gas isn't going to necessarily be the hat that you're wearing when you're putting in your application for the pipeline part.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. Now, having gone briefly through the current law on the basic tax levy, how does the bill propose to change that? The bill section 15 would repeal and reenact section 011E, and it actually is quite a bit simpler than the existing law because since progressivity is proposed to be handled on an annual basis, all we need to do is have one single percentage rate that applies to the production tax value of oil and gas. So Bill Section 15 says you start with the tax value under 160, just as under current law, and you multiply it by a tax rate, and that's determined under subsection G. Okay, what does subsection G say? Well, the tax rate is 25% plus the progressivity tax rate, which is determined under H. And the progressivity tax rate is similar, but slightly different numerically from the current formula. It starts with a trigger of when the net value exceeds $30 a barrel rather than 40 under current law. It goes up at a slower rate, though, 1/5 of a percentage point rather than 1/4 of a percentage point for each dollar over the trigger value. And again, it's calculated on an annual rather than a monthly basis.
Mr. Mintz, in that respect, since you authored this, is that a good?
I did most of the drafting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is, are we, should we like this because it's just much more simple and everybody can understand it, or is that just a comment, it's simpler?
Well, of course, I would, Mr. Chairman, everything else being equal, simpler is better. But no, I would say it's really the policy call that should drive the legislature's decision.
So the difference in calculating the two has nothing to do with one so complex we may not understand it. It's just one's just a bit simpler in calculating, is it?
Let's put it this way. It's happenstance that the policy call that the administration is proposing in this case also has the benefit of being a little bit simpler in terms of drafting and applying and understanding.
Okay. Thank you.
As with current law, there are two big exceptions to the general tax mechanism of a percentage of value, and one is the North Slope tax floor. Bill Section 16 replaces the current tax floor with a different tax floor, which applies to what have been called legacy fields. And these are units for, just to cover all bases, in the case of a non-unitized reservoir that has, meets two criteria: total production to date of at least 1 billion barrels and recent daily production of at least 100,000 barrels a day. And for these units, the minimum tax is 10% of the gross value at the point of production. The other big exception is the Cook Inlet tax ceilings, which are dealt with in Section 19 and 20.
Excuse me, Mr. Mance, could you go back and walk us through a scenario of what you just described?
Sure. Let's say Legacy Field A, which meets the criteria for the 10% floor. In any given year, let's suppose that if you multiply, let's suppose that progressivity is not triggered that year, so the tax rate is 25% of net value. Let's suppose that...
When you say the progressivity is not treated, what would the circumstance be that caused that would not happen?
Okay. That would be if the net value of the oil and gas produced from this legacy field did not exceed $30 per barrel.
Yeah, that's important for the public to understand.
Yeah, I'm assuming that, just to make the example simpler, that there's no progressivity factor, there's no progressivity percentage because of the trigger hasn't been reached.
Right. So it's below $30 a barrel, is that
right? Okay, just for the sake of the example. And let's suppose that this legacy field A generated a total production tax value of a little over $2 billion. Let's say $2 billion in that calendar year. 25% tax rate times $2 billion is $500 million. So that would be the tax it would pay using the percentage of value. Now, then you compare that to 10% of gross value at the point of production. Again, just hypothetically, let's suppose that you do that calculation and you get $400 million. In this case, the tax you pay under the percentage of value formula, $500 million, is greater than the tax floor, so you pay $500 million. Now, one of the rules to implement the tax floor, which comes later in the bill, is that if you're producing from a legacy field, you cannot apply tax credits to reduce your actual tax paid below the floor. So in this case, the tax levied is $500 million. If the producer had, say, $200 million of tax credits available, he could only apply $100 million that year to bring the actual tax paid down to $400 million. Now, let's take another example. Let's suppose that either prices are lower, costs are higher, and the total net value of oil and gas produced during a calendar year from a legacy field A is only $1.2 billion. And the 25% tax rate times $1.2 billion is $300 million. And you compare that to the $400 million, which is 10% of the gross value, you've fallen below the floor, so you have to pay what the floor says, which is $400 million.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Now, turning to the second major exception to the general tax mechanism, the Cook Inlet tax ceilings, these have not been changed. There are just some conforming amendments. And there's Section 21 has some technical language that is probably almost inexplicable by itself. And this is essentially a conforming amendment to a later provision of the bill, which has to do with the rules on deducting lease expenditures. And just very briefly, the existing law has a, what I would kind of call an anti-double dipping provision for use of tax credits in Cook Inlet. which is intended to prevent, in some cases, exporting tax credits that you would otherwise use, but you don't have to use because of the tax floor, and it prevents exporting those elsewhere in the state, because that would kind of be double-dipping, getting a double benefit from the tax floor. And later on in the bill, Section 55, there are some rules about how lease expenditures are deducted, which also implements an anti-double-dipping concept. And this technical language in Section 21 of the bill basically is meant to prevent, is meant to make sure that the anti-double-dipping under Section 55 isn't applied twice against the producer. In other words, if you've used up your excess lease expenditures under Section 55, then you don't have to do it again under Section 21. It's kind of an anti-double-dipping from the state standpoint, qualification to the anti-double-dipping provision for the producer standpoint. It's just basically a fairness, a little twist to ensure that it works fairly and doesn't overly penalize producers. And we can go into more detail if you want later when we get to Section 55. But I should mention, this basically is already in the current implementing regulations. But because there are a lot of unanswered questions in the existing law about how all these different provisions fit together, we thought it best to make it explicit in the statute.
Senator Huggins, I'm going to give a shot at it's anytime you get into the details, it gets very complicated. So I tested this with Rob and said, am I getting this right? And I'm gonna try this just to explain the Cook Inlet piece. What essentially happens at Cook Inlet is if you calculate their tax under PPT, you would apply deductions, leasehold expenditure deductions of your CapEx and your OpEx, and draw down your number. And then you would apply capital credits and then be able to draw down the number yet again. But we have this other rule on the side that says, oh, by the way, you never ever, you know, you pay the ELF ceiling. I mean, essentially, that'll be the lowest you can drag your tax. So the assumption is, to the extent that you had your PPT up here and it drew down with expenses and it drew down with capital credits, and somewhere you crossed the line and said, whoop, there's my ELF ceiling, I can stop now. What it's saying is that you as a producer can't say, well, this was my tax I paid, so now I'm going to go back and grab these capital costs and these expenditures, and they technically didn't get used because I paid this rate. Now I'm going to take them and throw them up to North Slope or throw them somewhere else. And they're saying, no, those are considered used, even though you may have ended up paying this rate. Mm-hmm. So that's the theory. But if you had capital credits that didn't get used to get you down to there, you still had some more left, then you can still use those and go throw them up to the North Slope, if that makes sense.
Okay, good, thank you. Okay, I'm sorry, proceed, please.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Marcia's explanation was much, much better than mine. Thank you for that.
See why we asked for her to come?
So now we come to Section 160, which tells how to calculate the actual taxable value that you apply the percentage tax rate to. And this is in Bill Sections 52 through 55. The basic principle remains the same. You start with the gross value at the point of production, and you subtract your lease expenditures. And there have been some changes in the wording. First of all, we could throw out half of it because you no longer need to calculate monthly values, because progressivity is now an annual concept. And second, the bill expresses a number of rules about when and how lease expenditures can or must be deducted. These are rules which are implicit in the current law, but they're not spelled out. And I think the reason for that is, if you go back to the history of the current law, the initial proposal that the previous administration submitted to the legislature was very uniform in how it treated oil and gas statewide, to the extent that if you're a producer in Alaska, in order to calculate your tax, you could add up the gross value of all your oil and gas produced anywhere in the state, get a single number, add up your lease expenditures incurred anywhere in the state, get a single number, and subtract one from the other. That's your production tax value. You multiply it by a percentage, and that's your tax. Over time, various exceptions and different treatment were introduced, specifically the Cook Inlet tax ceilings, the North Slope tax floor, and a special credit for production taxes outside of either the Cook Inlet or North Slope. And that required some degree of what we call ring fencing, that is separately calculating the taxable value in these different areas. And to reconcile those ring fencing concepts with the general concept that you want to basically deduct all your available expenditures in that year rather than carrying them forward is a little bit complicated, and the rules had to be worked out, and they've been worked out in regulation. But since we have an opportunity to revisit the statute, we feel it's much more desirable to state these basic rules in the bill. And in addition, now that we realize more what the challenges are of reconciling these two principles, I think the language has been made clear and simpler. And so that's the other reason for the change in the language in section 160. Just a couple of examples of why we need the rules that are stated in the bill. In the case of the legacy field tax floor, if you can imagine, going back to my example, for a legacy field, you calculate the taxable value, multiply that by the tax rate, and compare the result to the floor. Well, if you're down to the floor, then you're not getting any benefit from deducting further lease expenditures. If you had your druthers, you'd export those lease expenditures and deduct them somewhere else. That would undercut the whole point of the floor. So we have basically you can't export lease expenditures from a legacy field to somewhere else. Another example of one of these rules is basically what Marcia just explained, that if you have lease expenditures in Cook Inlet that you don't need because, for example, you're already down to zero, or perhaps you're not even producing, you're still exploring, you'd rather export those somewhere else and reduce your taxes, say, on the North Slope. But that would basically constitute double dipping if you're not required first to deduct them in Cook Inlet.
Mr. Mitch, one second. We've been joined by Senator Terrio and Senator Ellis. Welcome. Welcome, Senator Terrio. As I understand it, there are some exceptions to, and I'm not sure whether this is the area, but as an example, between Kaparik and Prudhoe, that there are some provisions. But help us out on that.
The different treatment for, which is legacy, which are essentially by definition now Prudhoe and Kaparik, that is the section F-160F that's referred to up there.
Okay.
And what's being done for those fields is they have the same PPT rate, they have the same productivity rate. The only difference is there is a floor, and what was in the bill before, which was a 4% floor applying to everything, now the floor has been contracted to just those two fields, and it's a higher floor of 10%. So that's the different treatment within legacy. The other piece is from when the bill was first introduced in draft to when it came out as a final bill, a change was made so that within Prudhoe and Kaparik, the ring fence ran around both of them. So now capital credits can move across those two units. And so the prohibition on exporting is really a prohibition from exporting outside of either of those two units, not a prohibition from taking anything from Kaparik to Prudhoe and from Prudhoe to Kaparik.
Right. That's the only exception to exporting?
That was the only difference, yes.
Right. And would you give us the rationale for why that change?
The rationale of that change was when the bill was first drafted, we were analyzing when the floor would kick in for each unit as a standalone unit. In other words, if you were to ask yourself West Coast price, you know, when would that field kick in, so that as we ran our modeling on what is the marginal tax rate and therefore what's the government take at each place, we found it to be too high for our comfort level. It was too aggressive in terms of applying a 10% floor to just Prudhoe or just Kuparik. They needed to be able to move the funds across the units to bring down the financial impact to the companies of having that floor. So it was our concern that we felt that was too harsh. And so by removing the ring fence, it substantially brought down when that trigger price would kick in. And now it's in the about $40 for, and we can't tell you specifically Prudhoe or Kuparik because that's taxpayer information. So just blended, we are looking at that 10% floor wouldn't kick in unless the on a blended basis the oil price on the West Coast was $40 or less.
Right. Was the industry consulted on the effects of the provision that you just described?
I had one conversation with ConocoPhillips, just confirming and letting them know that was sort of how we saw it in terms of the numbers, and my sense was they were listening to what we were saying and going off and doing their analysis. I did not ask them to tell me what they thought the crossover was. They did share some information with us on heavy oil in Kuparik and sort of the impact that they were seeing. So there was a bit of a dialogue. My guess is we'll see a lot more here in the presentation.
Please, Mr.
Mitch. Mr. Chairman, just so the record is clear, the final bill, there's still ring fencing separately for legacy fields for deductions, but what was changed is that capital credits can be transferred from one legacy field to another, and that's in section 023A. We'll get to that in a minute. We just dealt with 160, which says that basically to get your taxable value, you subtract lease expenditures from gross value. 165 tells you what lease expenditures are and what qualifies and what doesn't. Now, 165A and B in sections 56 through 59 have been rewritten to some extent and reorganized. One reason is for more clarity. An example. The current law defines lease expenditures as including certain, first of all, as being direct costs, and it defines direct costs as including certain overhead. And the problem with that is just terminologically, everywhere else in accounting and tax and everything, overhead is by definition an indirect cost. So it's a little bit confusing terminologically. But this has just been reworded and reorganized. Substantively, there's no change. We just no longer call the overhead allowance a direct cost. It's just a separate item. But the more substantive change is that current law allows but does not require that the concept of lease expenditure be implemented by regulation. And it was the department's judgment this time that that to ensure basically greater control by the department and greater transparency and predictability, that lease expenditures are expressly provided that in order to be deductible lease expenditures, the department must affirmatively allow them by regulation. The other substantive change to section 165 is the repeal of current subsection C and D. These provisions basically provided a second track for determining what are allowable lease expenditures. The first track is the general concept as implemented by the department, either by regulation or by case-by-case interpretation. But the second track was that let's say you have a unit operating agreement under which an operator sends monthly bills to its partners for the costs of running the unit. And if the department under subsection C or D determined that the rules in that operating agreement were substantially consistent with the rules defining lease expenditures in general, the department could allow or require the producers in that unit to basically substitute the billings, or what's allowed to be billed under the operating agreement, for the general concept of lease expenditures. And you know, there's some advantages and there's some disadvantages to doing that, but it was the department's judgment after reviewing this, and also after grappling with the implementation problems in the course of trying to develop implementing regs, that the disadvantages outweigh the advantages, and that it's better to have a single uniform definition, a specification of allowable lease expenditures in regulation. So this bill does propose to repeal subsection C and D.
And Mr. Mintz, just so that we have a good example of that, could you walk us through a scenario that makes the application of that provision?
Sure. Well, let's take let's just call it Unit A, where you have several producers that have interest in a unit. Well, let's go back a step. A unit is basically a group of oil and gas leases or tracts that have different ownership. And when you have different ownership over an oil or gas reservoir, it can basically impede the efficient development of the reservoir. And the easiest way to see this is to think about, sometimes the most efficient way to produce oil from a reservoir is to inject water into some parts of it and drive the oil into other parts of it where it's produced. Well, if you own leases in the area where water is being injected, you're not getting any production. So that's not going to appeal to you. So in order to overcome that problem, you treat all of the leases as if they're a single lease. And if you own a lease on the outside, instead of getting the oil that's produced from your lease, you get a share of the oil that's produced from everywhere in the unit. So basically, that's why we have units. And typically, the lessees, the producers, have one of their group actually operate the unit, and that operator incurs the expenses and bills the other producers, its partners, for their share. And the thought was, and the operating agreement typically defines the costs that are allowed to be billed. The thought was that, you know, the partners are not interested in paying more than they need to, any more than the state is interested in their deducting more than we want them to. And so if the department looked at this operating agreement and looked at the rules for what costs could be billed and determined that those rules pretty much conform to what would be allowed to be deducted, then the thought was, instead of having kind of a two-step process where the producers get billed and then they look, when it comes to determining what they can deduct for their taxes, they look somewhere else and see what the department allows, that the department say, just you can deduct what you're allowed to, what can be billed under the operating agreement. So that's how it would work. As I say, there are implementation problems with that. In addition, even though once you get to that point of approving the agreement, you could say there's some administrative savings. The fact is, you have to have these two separate tracks in order to administer the two subsections along with the general definition. And it didn't seem that it was going to be in the state's interest to implement these two separate tracks.
So in your estimation as a professional that drafted this, your confidence level in what we're using as a concept of operation here is functional and is preferred course?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I wasn't sure.
What you just described there, you support that fully?
The repeal?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's really a policy call. I'm not confident to make. But in terms of implementation, and you know what makes sense in tax administration, that there's no problem in repealing. I mean, it was kind of a novel approach. It was certainly worthy of consideration, but when the department looks at the implementation problems and the control problems and decides as a policy matter that it's better to get rid of these provisions, I have no quibble with that.
Senator Huggins, we discussed this earlier in this body, and this is a slightly different view of it from more of an administrative side. And I'd like to share what I learned whenever I talked with our auditor staff who would be charged with implementing, you know, the chief of the auditing section. I come at this from a background where I was 9 years in big oil and dealt from the other side of it in terms of dealing with the accounting side, the operating agreement implementation, how you would deal with other working interest owners, how you would deal with audit questions and audit challenges. So I appreciate fully what's going on the other side of the fence. What I didn't really appreciate was what was going on the state side. So I approached this with what's the big deal? Seems like it should work. And so I sat down and chatted with them, and as I started to walk with them down the path that they would have to take to get to this phase to actually implement and adopt an operating agreement as the proxy or surrogate for looking and examining leasehold expenditures, I realized that the challenge for them was, one, recognizing how dysfunctional at times the audit proceedings can be on the owner side. And frankly, you know, I can say yes, you know, the state has nothing on, you know, other people as far as being dysfunctional at times. Owners get in debates, they get in disputes. There are lots of challenges within that group, and the time frame within which it takes to resolve those debates can be anywhere from a year to 7 years resolving. So, and they can be on items, they're typically item-specific basis. So as we say, if our auditors were required to look at an operating agreement and say, well, generally, functionally, it should work. So we'll turn a blind eye and say, put it on autopilot, leasehold expenditures, sure, whatever they say. Problem is, they aren't fully in agreement, and it changes as they get through audits and challenges. And as new events arise, new issues arise. And so it's such a dynamic process on the operating owner and working interest owner side that the amount of time it would take for our auditing staff to look at it, revisit it when there are challenges or issues, rethink whether or not that is or isn't appropriate. And then the problem is, this basically only gives them sort of carte blanche to say it's in as an operating agreement in its entirety or it's out. So what we thought of is we would back up and instead take this deference or this ability to put weight on the industry's resolution of what expenditures should be in or out of leasehold expenditures and backed it into a different provision, which is the one that's in Section 57, which mandates for the department to consider what the operating agreement provides is an appropriate expense. And we can use that on an item-by-item basis. So we get the benefit of the operating agreement, but we're not tied whole hog to the whole process, either in or out. Instead, we can, where the things are working well, operating agreement, we've looked at it, seems fair, we can lock that in and move on. And then when new things come up, we can take our time, let the owner sort it out, look at it, say it's sorted out, it matches reasonable accounting practices, boom, that's locked in. So we think we've captured the benefit of being able to require the department to look at how the operating agreement and the owners are handling their leasehold expenditures and where it's appropriate, grab them, lock them in. It gives flexibility on both sides, mm-hmm. and it recognizes, frankly, the reality of how much time and how much dynamic changes there are in the way operating owners work out their costs with each other.
I guess the one thing to me is, as a member of the committee, that sort of rings a question mark is novel approach. Mm-hmm. But we'll get hung up with the words. There are two litmus tests that I run through my mind. One, is it operationally sound? Number two, is it durable? Mm-hmm. And your answer to those,
that,
is it operationally sound?
Our approach is more operationally sound, and it's more durable.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we've just been talking about basically determining what costs are allowable as lease expenditures. Current law has a long list of items which are expressly excluded, and the bill adds somewhat to that list. Paragraph 6 has an exclusion for costs arising from, I think it's fraud, willful misconduct or gross negligence, and so we're adding a couple of categories which seem like they would make sense, that you wouldn't want the producers to be able to deduct costs that arose from a violation of law or from failing to comply with a lease or permit obligation.
Senator Huggins, on this one, just since we have folks watching, I just want to note that this change actually arose out of an interested citizen's note of concern that came in and said, gee, you know, I have this concern, why doesn't it do this? And we all looked at it and said, good point. So I just wanted to put a shout out to the folks that may be watching that, in fact, when they do send in comments to their legislators and to, you know, the administration, when they raise good ideas, they actually sometimes get acted on.
Right. That's why Senator Green and I like those people from MATSU with that kind of vision. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the second category of expanded exclusions, paragraph 15, this is often called DR&R. At the end of a field life, there can be quite extensive costs involved in dismantling and removing and restoring. The current law allows those costs to be deducted to the extent that they're attributable to future production but not past production. But upon revisiting this, the department feels that it's really not good policy for the state to, in effect, subsidize ending production, and that we're really talking about sharing in the cost of exploring for and producing, and not the cost of shutting down. So this would basically say any DR&R costs are not deductible.
And also, Senator Huggins, we looked at this, and under the lease, the owners are obligated to do this, and they signed on from this for the very beginning. So again, if you back up and ask yourself, where do you want to put your credits? What do you want to incentivize? Generally, you want to incentivize that which someone might not do or might not be obligated to do. So, you know, in this case, our dollars are being used to support something that they're already legally required to do.
Paragraph 19 deals with an issue that was the subject of legislative efforts last session. I believe SB 80 was the vehicle. And this has to do with whether or not the state should share in the cost, including in the case of capital costs, giving credits for repairing or replacing facilities or equipment such as pipelines that may not have been maintained the way we would hope. And it addresses that issue in a slightly different way. Rather than look at the conduct of the producer, it looks at kind of more objectively, we think, at the event that is associated with the need for the repair or replacement. And if the repair or replacement is necessitated by some event which causes an interruption of oil or gas production, or if the repair or replacement causes an unscheduled drop in oil or gas production, then those repair or replacement costs would not be deductible. Similarly, if the repair or replacement were necessitated by an oil spill or some other kind of release of a hazardous substance, then the state would not share in those costs either.
Senator Wagner.
Mr. Davis, maybe you can answer this. In relation to 19, repair replacement facilities, do you know yet how much OPEX was billed against the state's credits by BP for the work on the pipeline?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, no, we don't.
So you don't know whether any
we do
portion,
know.
Now they sent a letter saying yes, if
that they have, yeah, I was just going to say
they would deduct those expenses.
That is correct.
Okay, so but we don't know yet how much of the expenses have been deducted by them up to this point, right?
That is correct.
Senator Wilkowski.
I think as I read this, the difference between what you're doing here and SB 80 is that, at least one difference that I see, is a company could have been negligent for decades on the North Slope, and then you're kind of giving them a pass if they go ahead and schedule to fix their negligence. Is that?
Senator Wilkowski, unless that negligence rises to the level of gross negligence, whereby it would be excluded under one of the other provisions, if someone were not grossly negligent but simply negligent, then what we're doing is we're saying we will not participate in the repair costs and the replacement costs where that negligence has caused unscheduled production impacts or releases, contamination. So to the extent that negligence is something that doesn't impact production or doesn't impact contamination, then we're still allowing the credits and the deductions to occur.
Just if I could follow, do you have any kind of comparison on how other regimes deal with this issue as far as you're placing a strict liability based on scheduled or unscheduled drops in production? Seems to me we don't want to condone negligence, but how do other regimes deal with this?
Senator Wilkowski, I don't think we have gone out and asked. First, we'd have to look at tax and royalty regimes. Production sharing countries generally sort of lock down all of their provisions in contract, and we can look at that, but it's not as informative as if we looked at statute and tax and royalty countries. And thinking off the top of my head, it's really going to be relevant only in those tax and royalty regimes that have credits. So that probably Norway might be instructive. So I don't know that we've specifically asked our experts for that, but we can. I think it's a good question, and we will.
Senator Wagner.
Marshall, when will we know? Will it be at the end of 3 years? When will we know how much expenses they're writing off?
There are a couple couple initiatives at the state that are going on different tracks. One is a legal inquiry that's undergoing right now that's in the Attorney General's office that is dealing with the, and I don't know what stage it's at, but there's some sort of legal action that's in process where the attorneys are talking and discovery is happening and, you know, people are starting to develop that case side. And once you get into litigation, then you have the right to ask the other side for documents and, you know, contractors and lawyers and everybody get involved. So there's an opportunity to develop that number and that analysis in that course. Separately, we as the taxing jurisdiction obviously are getting our, we have a bit of 2006. We will have the 2007 returns filed on, October 1st? Yeah, October 15th. We basically get the revised ones at the end of the month. October 31st is when all their federal return stuff is due. So we will be able to see returns there. It won't give us as much detail, but that then enables us to begin an audit process. And our goal will be to get after an audit on one of these pretty quickly. So within a year after that, so potentially within a year, we would know what's going on as far as deductions from the DOR's auditing efforts. The legal efforts may produce an answer sooner.
Go ahead, Mr.
Chairman, the final addition to the list of exclusions is paragraph 20, which relates to the cost of either acquiring or constructing or operating a crude oil topping plant or refinery. Now, what this has to do with is the fact that sometimes right in the field, producers want to produce their own diesel, it would be the best example, for use as fuel or otherwise. And sometimes they choose to obtain that by building their own little topping plant rather than just buying the fuel. And it's the department's judgment, it's expressed in paragraph 20, that that is really not what is meant by direct cost. That's getting pretty indirect when you make your own plant to produce a product that you then use in operations. So The paragraph 20 would exclude deductions for constructing or operating the plant itself. However, it does allow for essentially deducting the value of the product, whether or not you build the plant or buy it. Because that does look like a direct cost of producing oil and gas. Now, there's a little twist on here which I just wanted to explain for the record. What's allowed to be deducted is the difference between the market value of the product and the value of the oil that's going into it. And the reason is because the oil is being produced from that field, and it's tax exempt. So if you allowed the deduction of that value, the tax exempt oil, you'd be double dipping, double counting. So it's the value added between the value of the oil that goes into the plant and the product that comes out of the plant that you can deduct. So if you think about it, if you're buying the fuel on the market, then the oil that you'd otherwise use to refine into it, you'd be selling and getting the value of that. So that's why just that detail is you deduct the value added rather than the value of the gross value of the product.
Yeah, Senator Stevens?
I'm sorry, you really lost me on that one. I understand that you would exclude the crude oil topping plant, but what is the value added? What is that deduction? Can you be real specific? I mean, you've got the issue of what it would cost you to buy the diesel and what you would get from selling the oil you turn into diesel.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, the complicated language is merely trying to allow an operator to deduct the value of the diesel that they use, either because they've bought it and shipped it up, or if they go ahead and say, even though we don't have a credit, we're still going to be making our diesel on the slope with our crude oil topping plant. When they reach in and grab a barrel of the oil out of the ground and throw it into the plant, they're allowed to take that barrel out and not have to pay tax because it's being used on the lease.
Right.
So what we're doing is saying, since you didn't have to pay tax on it, when you go to deduct it from your tax because of the fair market value of what a diesel thing is, we're going to make you take out the piece you didn't pay tax on. That's all. So it's essentially not letting them get a free barrel and then deducting it from us.
Thank you.
Yeah, Marcia, let me just ask you in the respect of, in the larger scenario, it appears to me that the question is, do you build a facility or do you truck it north? Is that true or false?
It's whether you build the facility and incur the cost,
right.
Build the facility and have the state incur 42.5% of the cost, or do you truck it? It is the frame of reference, and what we're trying to do is make one of those options, which is build the facility and have the state pay 42.5% of the cost, not one of the options.
Yeah, I guess my concern from a practical standpoint, and I mentioned this early, but I'll repeat it. It's Wyoming, wide open place, and they're now starting to manage their truck traffic on the roads because of some challenges they've had in road repairs and what have you. And, you know, I think it's probably much more difficult for us to maintain the Dalton Highway than it is probably for Wyoming to maintain most of their roads. And for us to potentially be going down the road of a course of action that would cause more trucking activity, that may be the right answer. I think it's important for us, though, it's important for the state, mm-hmm. to make sure that we can live with the consequences if mm-hmm. they choose that course mm-hmm. of action.
Senator Huggins, I think that's a very good question. I think we owe you an answer to, because you're being asked to trade off, what will be the cost of the state to maintain the roads, you know, resulting from potentially increased truck traffic, versus what is the cost of the state in not paying 42.5% of the cost of these plants and future plants. And so you need to understand what is the economic trade-off that we're making here.
Right. Yeah, okay. I mean, and it goes beyond that. I mean, you two trucks head on spill, contamination, family gets killed, I mean, all those things, which equals people driving on the road.
Sure, sure.
And just make sure we can live with the consequences that we may be creating, may not be. I mean, they may say we're going to build it, doesn't matter.
No, understood, and that's why I kind of flinched when Rob called it a little plant. I mean, our understanding, the quotes we're getting are about $300 million just to modify the Kaparik plant, let alone what would it would cost to build a new plant. So, you know, what we're hearing is we've got two plants up there, neither of which are conforming for sulfur, so those are two different plants that would potentially create a $300 million bill, plus potentially a third plant as they step out and do remote work where they may need to have another plant. So these are not small ticket items. We got sticker shock when we saw that and started thinking about should the state, apart from our concern that it's not definitionally part of the upstream cost in that chain of point of production up is an upstream cost. It really is a, once you produced it, take it off now, go refine it. Apart from our concern about that, our concern is even if we wanted to, if the state wanted to do this from a policy standpoint, you know, you need to understand what the price tag is for that policy versus the alternative. And that gets right to the question you're asking.
Right. Senator Wagner.
Well, I was just going to say, I think Tesoro's plant modification and expansion for their low sulfur unit is somewhere over $50 million. But they're producing, I think, enough low sulfur fuel for the state at this time. And I don't think North Slope's taken into consideration. So I don't understand why it would take $300 million mm-hmm. to make a modification of that plant up there that would give them a low sulfur diesel, unless it's something pretty radical that they had to do that.
Yeah. Senator Wagner, I don't know, but I do know that there are environmental challenges on the slope relative to the air emissions. In whether they have different standards or not on the slope, I don't know. That may be driving some of the higher costs associated with what they have to do.
Okay, thank you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we've gone through calculation of the percentage of value tax, and then when the producer figures out how much tax has been levied, then before determining how much actually has to be paid, the question of tax credits come into play. And so there are a number of provisions of the bill that amend the current tax credit provisions of the production tax law. Section 023A is the existing provision that provides for a 20% tax credit for qualified capital expenditures. A few changes are proposed in the current bill. First of all, a limitation it requires the credits to be spread out a bit over time. No more than 50% of a credit may be taken the first year.
Mr. Bishop, let me stop you right there. What is the value of that provision?
The value, as we analyzed it, Senator Huggins, is not so much that it's going to save the state total dollars, but what it does is it dampens the amplitude of the swings from year to year, so that from a budgeting standpoint, as you recall, yesterday and the day before, there was testimony about the lumpiness in capital expenditure spend, and they talk about the big lump on the front end. But there are also lumps as you go through field life where you decide to do a water flood, or you do an EOR program, or you suddenly put in an initiative to drill a bunch of multilateral wells, so that your capital spend maybe have peaks like this every 2 or 3 years. And so under the current system, those peaks hit in a single year, and the state's budgeting essentially has to absorb it so that we, as far as your ability to plan revenue and spend it, by requiring that they be spread over 2 years, we dampen that spike so it's half as high and it carries over to the next year, so that we sort of try to keep the extremes down. It doesn't necessarily, it won't necessarily change the total dollar other than a little bit of time value. There might be, you know, a small amount, but that wasn't really the driving factor from our analysis of trying to figure out why we would do this. It was more to try to assist with the spend. And we felt pretty comfortable doing it once we had done the analysis of looking at other tax and royalty regimes. Norway was considered to have a highly accelerated depreciation schedule, and that was at 6 years, because the federal government's at 8 years. So we were all at 1 year. So we thought by spreading it out 2 years, it wasn't a huge difference in our competitive advantage.
Right. And what do our business partners, what's their perspective on this? Or have you...
We haven't heard any comments from them on that one. I will say probably the smaller companies, like a Pioneer or something, you know, they would obviously potentially care about having the full credit to be able to sell in 1 year versus selling half 1 year and half the other, because again, the part of the time value. But again, looking at the total economic benefit, it's still substantial for them. But it does cut it back a little for them.
Right. So, and you mentioned Pioneer. Did we look at the implications of having a provision that took into account the size of the organization and their ability to?
That arose once we got here, and I think we heard that from a legislator. I mean, we would be open to that notion. I mean, I think that would be a reasonable way to moderate its effect on the players that are new entrants that don't have current tax. Yeah. And you could do a size so that it doesn't sort of eat out, put us back up into a spike zone.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to deduce here for a moment, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my gut feeling that our future in the development is the pioneers of the world. Mm-hmm. Smaller organizations, mm-hmm. partnered, I mean, whatever it turns out to be. And if we're looking to do incentives, then we need to look at what are disincentives. So could you bring us something
sure.
back that...
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Senator Wilkowski,
sorry. The testimony we had yesterday from Gaffney Klein, I thought was very compelling in that, particularly regarding the discount rate and how industry has 10%, we have 5%. I don't know if that's quite accurate, but it seems to me that this is one of those knobs that we can turn to really help ratchet investment, to help ratchet up the internal rates of return. Mm-hmm. And it really, if we can figure out a way to do it so it doesn't have quite the budgetary impacts on our state, this is a really good thing to do, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this upfront credit to
sure.
the industry, because I do think it does increase investment probably pretty significantly, because it pushes that money forward mm-hmm. and really boosts, jacks up their internal rates of return. Mm-hmm. But what are we talking about when you talk about the spikes? I mean, are we talking hundreds of millions or?
Again, in terms of looking at specific fields, the problem is we'd have to look at it on a taxpayer basis, you know, in terms of where the spikes are. But I guess I'd have to come back and show you a year cycle to the extent we have information on the CapEx spend for those years. And I'll get with Sherry and see if I can show you sort of what range we're looking at. And the challenge is also into the future. How the spend has been to this point in time may be a very different picture than what the spend is going to look like from this day forward, with aging fields and aging infrastructure, where you may have whole-scale replacements of systems every 3 or 4 years, which could create bigger spikes than we've ever seen. And Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I mean, you're absolutely right as far as the leveraging pieces of a fiscal system. One of the things we learned as we were able to model new fields and look at which change made a difference, and it was clearly getting capital returned early that made a huge difference when they assessed what the net present value of a project looked like and whether they would want to invest or not. So this is a powerful one.
Yeah, and I would put an exclamation point behind Senator Wilkowski's point. Now, Marcia, that help me out if I'm wrong here, but in our quest for more information, aren't we asking for projections of these spikes?
To the extent we know. To some extent, it's the unknowable, because it's the unexpected things that sometimes create the spikes. But to the extent we know of spikes coming, for instance, you're going to see a spike if any of these heavy oil pilot projects take off, which are going to require the construction of large power plants, and they're going to require the construction of some unique systems, you know, to handle sand and different things. So in the years that those go in, you will see, you know, big spikes as those come in. So to the extent we can look ahead down the road and anticipate the kinds of projects and the dollar cost associated with the capital spend, we will try to do that. But again, the challenge is knowing the time frame and knowing what they are.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, turning to the second change to the capital credit provision, as excuse me, as Kevin Banks explained last night, there have been a number of changes to Section 025, the exploration incentive credits, one group of which has to do with additional or clarified or expanded information submission requirements. Now, the current law under 023A, the capital credits, also provides that if you want a capital credit under 023A rather than an exploration incentive credit under 025 for an exploration expenditure, you also have to agree to the same information submission requirements that you would have to comply with under 025. Since those submission requirements under 025 have been changed, there's just a conforming change under 023A to make sure that you have to provide the same information to the state, whether you're doing it under 025 or 023A. So I would call it basically a conforming change.
Let's walk through a scenario on that so that we understand what okay. you said. So I understand what you said.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, Section 025, the Exploration Incentive Credit Program, predates the PPT legislation. That was a separate targeted set of credits with its own sunset provision, and it was targeted towards certain types of exploration activities. And depending on the type of the category, there could be either a 20% or a 40% credit. When the PPT legislation was enacted, one of the basic philosophies was not to try and change parts of the existing law that didn't need to be changed. So basically 025, the exploration incentive credit provisions, were pretty much left alone. There were some conforming changes made, but they were pretty much left alone. We had this whole new, very broad credit provision under 023, which said any capital expenditure that also is a lease expenditure. In other words, if you incur an expenditure to explore for, develop, or produce oil or gas, and if it's a capitalized type of expenditure, then you can get a 20% credit for that. Well, there's a big overlap between that and the exploration expenditures. The exploration expenditures under 025 are much narrower, but they're a subset of the broad category under 023. In a sense, if you qualify for a 20% credit under 023, you may not care that much whether you apply under 023. I'm sorry, if you qualify for a 20% credit under 025, the existing exploration incentive credit program, it's not that different whether you do it under that program or under the new program, 023A. But what we want to make sure is if an explorer does it under 023A, it's not in order to escape the obligations to provide exploration data to DNR. So when 023A was enacted, it said basically, if you're an explorer, you're doing exploration, you have to comply with the same information submission requirements that you would have to under the existing exploration incentive program. And since those have been changed in the bill, they're also changed in 023A.
Thank you.
I'm sure Marcia could have explained much better. I hope that was...
You did great. You did great.
No, that was good. Very good.
The final change in 023A is something which basically helps to implement the tax floor for legacy fields. And it provides that if there is a capital expenditure incurred in a legacy field, that the credit for that expenditure can only be applied against a tax on a legacy field. And the reason for that is, again, if we didn't do that, then it would undercut the tax floor, because tax credits which would which a producer would not be able to use in a legacy field because it would reduce the tax payment below the floor. If you could just export it somewhere else, then you're getting around the floor. That's what this is all about.
So really, I mean, you could substitute legacy field. I know you don't want to do that, but you could do that, and it would be more descriptive. But I'm not asking you
right,
that.
Right.
The second major credit provision of the PPT law, which is only slightly changed, is the so-called carry-forward annual loss credit. And all this means is that if you're a producer that maybe you're not even producing yet, but you're still developing, so you're incurring a lot of costs, or you're an explorer that incurs costs, or you're a producer that's operating at a loss, there are costs which you would otherwise be able to deduct, but you can't get your taxable value below zero, so you can't deduct them that year. Instead, you can carry them forward. When you carry them forward, instead of being a deduction, we turn them into a credit. It has the same economic effect. Because of the floor on the legacy fields, in order to basically make that floor more effective, if you run a loss in a legacy field, you can't carry those forward under the proposed bill. Now, there actually is a kind of conforming change that I think I neglected to include in my presentation, but I should mention it. Because the tax rate under the bill is 25%, that when you deduct a cost in calculating your taxes, your after-tax cost is 75%. You get 25% deduction. So when you turn a cost into a credit for carrying forward to get the same economic impact, the credit also is 25% of the cost. That's the current law has a kind of anomaly in that respect, because even though the tax rate is 22.5%, it only provides for 20% loss carry forward credit. Our proposal is to conform the tax rate for the loss carry forward to the tax rate that's imposed in calculating your tax. So that's changed from 20% to 25% in the bill.
Senator Huggins, that was one of the provisions we'd heard from the smaller players or the new entrants, that they felt disadvantaged because, unlike incumbents who had ongoing production and could capture the full 22.5% value of that expenditure, they only had the option of carrying forward 20% and then monetizing it into a capital credit, so they felt disadvantaged.
Current subsection D of section 023 provides for transferable tax credit certificates. This is the mechanism by which an explorer or producer that doesn't have tax liability to apply the credit against can turn it into value by getting a certificate and then selling it, or in the case of the new provision we're proposing, having the state purchase it. And really the only significant change here is to conform the credits, the certificates, to the 50% rule that applies to the capital credits. There's a provision that basically half of a credit can be used immediately and the other half cannot be used until the next year.
And Senator Huggins, along the lines of what you requested us to do, where we would look at either a small producer or a small size, some cap on the size of the limitation on the credit, if we're going to allow that smaller class to be able to do all of theirs in 1 year, then we'll need to make a slight modification to this so that their certificate doesn't get split in two.
Yes. Senator Wagner?
Yeah, I concur with that because, number one, it'd be simpler. And the simpler we keep this thing, the better. But, you know, time, value, money, we're penalizing a smaller operator at 50, whatever the value of money is over the 1 year, we're penalizing that much. Mm-hmm. And I just can't see doing that. I really can't see doing that to a big operator either. So I don't know that we need to.
Do we know how much money?
Need to separate those two. I think we may need to look at changing and just saying this can be done 100% the time and credits issue.
Yeah, no, and.
Yeah, I think we've got an evaluation of what the time value cost is to the state apart from any revenue planning aspect, so we can bring that to you.
What is the value of this? I mean, you don't have to answer that right now.
Yeah, it's relatively small in terms of the time value difference for us. So that's not, that wasn't the driving factor, so we can bring that in and let you have that to evaluate.
Bob, you're doing good.
Thank you.
Robert, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, I think the committee's already heard about this next change, but there could be a potential anomaly in the tax law if a entity, typically a municipality that's tax exempt, were able to get a tax credit certificate for expenditures and then get money back from the state. So this clarifies that if you're tax exempt, you can't do that.
Now, have we arm wrestled over this provision before, or no?
No, I don't think so. I think essentially.
Just clarification, okay.
Clarification.
Good, next.
Is this only municipality, or would there be any other?
It's the.
Other tax exempt entities out there?
We checked with the DNR, and that is the only tax exempt entity that holds oil and gas leases.
Right.
That is not subject to a tax, not subject to the production tax. And the reason is there's this constitutional issue about taxing, the state taxing municipalities, which is what creates this anomaly. So that's what takes them outside the tax, which then we are finishing by taking them outside the credits.
So a native corporation would not be tax exempt?
No, they would not be impacted, yeah, they would not be impacted by this, that's correct. They would not be tax exempt.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the final change to the '023 credits is very significant. It's short and sweet because it's just a repealer. But what it repeals is the transitional investment expenditure credits. This had a number of different nicknames, but it basically provides credits for certain capital-type expenditures that were made during the 5 years before the PPT started on April 1st, 2006.
This is the infamous clawback and two-for-one, and as I recall, you did the two-for-one, Senator Wagner?
I did the two-for-one, but I called it a kick. I did not like it, and I still don't like it. You know, as a businessman, when I made a decision to purchase equipment, I didn't make that decision thinking that maybe in 5 years things would change, so therefore I would get additional credit for my investment. I wrote off my taxes as I could and depreciated it out, and that's just the way you do business. And I just never thought, I've never heard of anything like this being done before.
Well, is Senator Huggins, just to mention, since I'd never heard Mr. Van Meer's speak in terms of, so I was listening with rapt attention as he went through what his proposals had been back in the '06, and I noted with interest that he too had said that he never proposed this tie credit and thought it was a bad idea. So I just reposit at least one of the expert statements from the past on that point.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, he said that very clearly. And I don't remember during the debate what his position was, but he clearly at that point, or when he was visiting with us. On the other hand, I think it's worth us exploring what the impact on smaller organizations are. It doesn't mean we have to change your proposal, but I also think that the part of what is the cause and effect of this for the smaller organizations, I have no idea what that is, I think it's important for us to know that. Yes, sir.
The most I don't know how to describe it, but some of the statements were made when we were in this discussion before was, well, had I known this was going to happen, I probably wouldn't have purchased that equipment to do that job at that time. I would have waited 5 years. And that doesn't ring true. And that was the most disingenuous part of the whole thing. And we were told that by a couple of companies. I can't cite chat reverse who it was and when it was, but I remember that being said. That just isn't the way you do business if you're doing business right. So.
And I agree with that 110%. But in the school of unintended consequences, if there are some, I mean, I think it's just worthy of us for the durability of what we're doing and our business partners, particularly the small ones.
Senator Huggins, what we can do is because there have been applications made by parties that have identified, assuming they, and as I recall from Sherry Nienhaus's testimony yesterday where she described this, we're aware of the ones who have filed applications to the extent they have production. We won't necessarily know about small producers or small players that have incurred costs that might qualify in that time period, but who have not yet developed, had any production, so they have no tax yet, so we aren't aware of what those costs are. But we'll do our best with the records we have to see if we can ferret out impacts on small producers.
Fair enough. Yeah. Mr. Manager?
Mr. Chairman, the next few slides deal with bill sections 36 through 44, which are changes to the exploration incentive credit program in section 025. I note that almost all of these changes that are summarized on the slides were described last night by Kevin Banks, and I'd be happy to go through them again, but if it's your pleasure, I would just mention a couple that I don't recall Kevin mentioning. Whichever way you'd like me to do it, I would be happy.
That's okay with me if it, other committee members buy into it.
Sure.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Okay. Section 37, Section 025, the Exploration Incentive Program, has a relatively limited universe of costs that are deductible. And it has a number of exclusions, but we're proposing to add one more, which is basically costs that are incurred as a result of gross negligence or violation of health or safety or environmental laws or regulations. That's all we're talking about there.
What was the impetus of that? I mean, that was the brainchild of someone.
I think the impetus was that there's some experience, recent experience with exploration activities that seem to be more expensive than they should have been because of problems that shouldn't have occurred. I don't know that this is kind of it's totally secondhand or third hand.
Yeah.
But it basically brought to light a potential loophole, so to speak, that the department thought was good to close.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes when for some reason I thought I heard you say welfare, health and welfare.
Health and safety.
And safety. You know, this business of health has a tremendously broad connotation.
Yes.
I think.
In Senator Huggins, hopefully it's a little more constrained than the broad topic in the sense that it is confined to statutes or regulations that deal with health, safety, or environment. Yeah. So it won't be a fishing expense.
Could you bring us back
expensive.
What that is so we know, I mean, what really?
Yeah, in terms of, it will probably be the DEC environmental statutes and regulations and OSHA laws would be in that category as well in terms of worker safety issues. So it's going to be laws that are on the books that operators and developers already know about and are allegedly complying with.
Yeah.
And the intent here is that if there is a cost or an expense that arises because an operator cut a corner, you know, ended up, violating an OSHA law or a DEC law and now is dealing with it, and those expenses get put in the bucket of, oh, by the way, state, here are my deductions. We want the legal authority to be able to say, strike, you know, we're not going to pay for costs that arise from violations of laws or regulations. And it's essentially a mirror provision to what already exists in the capital expenditure section, which disallows these types of violation, illegal sort of resulting things.
Yeah, placate me and give me a synopsis
sure.
of what we're talking about. But I just don't want to see us get into a lawyerly playground here.
Sure.
But okay. Go ahead.
And then I think the only other point that I don't recall Kevin mentioning, Section 39, again, applying the 50% rule to certificates under the exploration incentive program to be consistent with how it's being treated elsewhere. I understand that there are some policy concerns, but this is just the third place where it comes up. So for completeness, I'm mentioning that one of the changes is to say that 50% of a credit can be used immediately, and the rest has to wait at least a year. All right, now we're leaving the credits provisions themselves and turning to the question of how you monetize credits if you're not able to apply them against your taxes, if you're an explorer or new producer. The current law has a provision in 023F which establishes some criteria for getting cash refunds for the state and provides for no more than $25 million in cash refunds for a particular applicant for a particular year. And
I'm sorry, Mr. Mintz, would you say that one more time?
Yeah.
You mentioned a price tag. I thought I heard you say.
Yes, there's a current law has a maximum of $25 million in refunds for an applicant for a year.
Right. And that's consistent with what we're fixing to do?
No, that's actually, that limitation is not in the current, is not in the new proposal. The new proposal repeals 023F and replaces it with a new system, an oil and gas credit tax fund, in a new section of the law, section 028. And it provides for funding that tax fund with a percentage of production tax revenues, either 10% or 15%, depending on the Department of Revenue price forecast. Other than the $25 million limitation, the existing criteria for whether you qualify to get a what's now called a purchase rather than a refund remain in effect. For example, you can't produce more than 50,000 barrels a day in order to qualify. You can't be delinquent on any of your tax obligations. And also, you have to have used up any credits against your tax liability before you can get a refund. And there are a variety of administrative reasons why this new approach is believed to be preferable and more effective at accomplishing the goal of basically giving 100% value for the credits that a producer or explorer earns, since the state's going to bear 100% of it anyway. And I'm sure if there are policy questions, Marsha would be much better at addressing those.
Yeah, I guess the question in my mind is, I mean, how big will this fund be? I mean, it says percentage of.
What we've done is we've looked at our track record so far on the credits. You know, they're higher than we thought, but we're looking at them. And so in terms of identifying, looking at the near years, how much money would need to be available to have enough funds on hand to fully refund the credits we're expecting. We, Sherry Nienhaus did the analysis and then did the forecast, and what she's seeing is consistently, and that's what we have in here, is if the price of oil is $60 or higher, 10% covers it. If it's less than $60, 15%, we're comfortable with that range, and with the idea that if there's money there, it can either stay or go away. We also were comfortable enough to eliminate the $25 million per applicant or per taxpayer, in part because we're not having the large companies come in and have credits, because clearly they have tax liability that's sufficient to absorb whatever capital credits that they have in the current year. So what we're seeing is it's the smaller producers who either do not yet have production. And those were the companies that talked to us and said, $25 million cap, again, looking for the bang for the buck, getting the money in their pocket near term, the $25 million cap was too low for the majority of the types of expenses that they were incurring. So we eliminated the $25 million, recognizing we still have the production limitation that keeps the zone down. And in terms of the flat dollar amount, what we think, I've seen the number, and I can bring that back to you in terms of what the size of the fund would be.
And just a mechanism for dealing with the annual cycle, is it lapse, or is it carryover?
Okay.
Whatever. Okay, Mr. Mintz.
Okay, so we've calculated how much tax is levied, we've applied credits, and now it comes time to pay the bill. The current system has a monthly installment payments of estimated tax and a final payment on March 31st. This is unchanged. But since the tax calculation has changed, we need to change the rules for how you calculate installment payments. So one set of changes in the installment payment provision is basically to conform to the changes in the tax. The other set of changes basically corrects what may have been an oversight in the original law, one of which was that Cook Inlet tax ceilings were not taken account of in your estimated payments under the statute, which means if you're a Cook Inlet producer, you're going to be required to overpay, which didn't make sense. So the statute clarifies that for Cook Inlet oil and gas subject to ceilings, you take account of those ceilings in calculating your estimated tax. Also, if you're a legacy field subject to a floor, you take account of the floor in calculating your estimated taxes. The last point on the slide is that installment payments do not take account of the progressivity rate. I think there's a practical problem in requiring that, which is simply that we would require predicting the movement of oil prices in the future, which I think we all know is not something which you can do with any confidence. That's my understanding of that.
Okay, so what was the old mechanism? What's the new mechanism on installment payments and progressivity rate?
Well, the old mechanism did take account of progressivity because that was calculated on a monthly basis.
Right.
So you could actually know what the tax is. But the new progressivity provision, you don't know if even progressivity is triggered or if it is, how much it is, until you know what the basically the price of oil is over the course of the year. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing, well, here are the things that go into calculating your estimated installment payments. One is your monthly production. Well, you know that every month. The second is your gross value at the point of production. You pretty well know that every month because you know what the price of oil is for that month. And the third is 1/12 of your annual cost. Now, that's to some extent a forecast, but the producers typically have a pretty good handle on their costs because they have to budget them in advance. So that's not too much of a stretch. But those are the things that go into the installment payment. A producer, in fact, cannot know exactly what the right amount is until March 31st, but you can get pretty close. The fourth element, as I say, involves predicting future oil prices, and I think in the department's judgment that's too much to expect a producer to do. And that's why the progressivity element is not included in the estimated taxes, but of course, on March 31st, when the taxes for the year are calculated, that's going to be part of the tax due.
Right. And so, just as an example, the producers would not be held accountable if the progressivity rate caused them to be out of tolerance.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah. But I guess I'm...
Senator Huggins, because we are doing the progressivity on an annual basis now,
right.
and the policy call there was because of the volatility of oil price up and down, the administrative time and efficiency for everyone to try to track it month to month and follow the spikes and then make sure it's all right and then challenge if it's wrong. We just thought that was a lot of effort for not a lot of money. And what we wanted to do is simplify and at least focus our efforts on things that mattered. And so we pushed the progressivity calculation to be an annual calculation. And since we're going to make it an annual calculation, we're not going to require the producers to predict is going to be at the end of the year. So instead, they can make their monthly payments without regard to progressivity, just flat. You know, it's based on the base tax rate. And when we get to the end of the year, when they file their return on March 31st, they will know, in looking at the full year, whether progressivity is kicked in, and they can do the simple math that will reapply a tax rate. So to the extent progressivity did kick in on an annualized basis, they'll be able to add that additional increment to the payment that's due when they file the return, and there will be no penalty associated with having that progressivity increment added if it's due.
Yeah, I don't know. It appears to me that that creates an automatic underpayment, which could be sizable, but I may be wrong on that.
But in our analysis is, I mean, we're not seeing it be a sizable number.
Okay. If you're happy, I'm happy on that one. Senator Wilkowski.
Sorry, I stepped out for a minute. I don't know if you covered this or not, but one of the recommendations that Dr. Van Muir had suggested was a penalty on underpayments or non-payments. Have you explored that? Would you be open to something on that to encourage correct payment of taxes?
Certainly, we want to have something that everyone views uniformly as being having sufficient teeth that are going to encourage people to not use the state as an ATM. I mean, essentially, we're not here to fund everyone else. So, you know, if the legislature looks at what we have here and doesn't believe we have adequate penalties, we're certainly open to what you would consider to be appropriate or reasonable penalties.
Okay. Didn't we come up with a certain percentage that was required on each payment of 95% or 100% with the true up once a year? Wasn't there, maybe that was just discussed.
No, that's true.
I know we had a lot of discussion about it.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagner, that was in various versions of the bill, kind of a safe harbor provision. That was not in the final PPT. There's no safe harbor, and in fact, interest is required on any underpayment or refunded on any overpayment. So that was a slightly different approach. But on the question of penalties, I'm not sure what Dr. Van Meers was referring to. I didn't hear that testimony, but existing law in AS 4305, which are the general administrative provisions for all the tax laws, have penalty provisions that are modeled after the IRS penalty provisions. And underpayments of tax are subject to civil penalties. There are at least two types. There's a 5% per month up to 25%, which applies unless the taxpayer can show reasonable cause and not willful neglect for the underpayment. And there's also a 5% of the total deficiency if any part of a deficiency is caused by intentional disregard of law or regulation. And there are also more substantial penalties in the case of intentional fraud. Now, I think, so these potentially apply to any underpayments, whether it's the annual payment or the monthly installment. Now, it is true that since you have to be a little bit more careful with the monthly installment payments because we know they're going to be off because it involves estimates of what you're ultimately going to owe. So you wouldn't expect that the department to be particularly harsh in using the penalty authority for installment payments. But if it was clear that a producer was intentionally underpaying because they said, well, the interest isn't that much, you know, I don't care, the department does have the authority to impose substantial civil penalties.
Certainly.
But then if, you know, and there are honest mistakes that are made, county-wise, so they're allowed, are they allowed to true up without penalty every month for the last month's underpayments? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagner, yes, I mean, as I said, if you can show that the underpayment was not due to willful neglect, but had reasonable cause, there's no penalty. You always pay interest because that's basically the time value of money.
They do pay interest.
Right? Yeah.
Or we give them a credit.
Either way.
Yeah, if I might just take a note here. Senator Davis has been with us for some period of time, and welcome, Senator Davis. Sorry I didn't recognize you earlier. Senator Wilkowski.
Just so the interest rate that they pay, I'm imagining, is probably around 3 or 4%.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wachowski, the interest rate for underpayments or overpayments on the estimated monthly payments is imports the IRS interest rate. I don't recall exactly what that is, but it's intended to be a market rate. And that's up until the next March 31st. Now, if there's an underpayment after the March 31st final date, that's subject to the regular state interest rate, which is usually substantially higher. It's 11% compounded.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, continue, please.
Now, a number of the provisions that deal with reporting, and this is similar, are in the nature of clarifying the department's authority to avoid potential disputes. The department does have broad reporting authority, but there are some specific types of reports that are very necessary for the administration of this law that the department wants to be sure there's no possibility for producers to argue about. So that's why there are a number of very specific reporting requirements placed in the law. Now, what we're looking at now is giving express authority to the department to require electronic payment of taxes, and in particular to require it in a form that will be most helpful for tax administration. Most taxpayers do pay electronically. Again, this is to eliminate any confusion or any room for arguing about the department's authority in this area.
Yeah. Just as a matter, and we're going to take a break until quarter after you answer this question. The question is, what forms of payment do we get now? I have no idea, but for the public, what are the forms of payment we get?
We get wire transfers. We can get
that's electronic.
Yeah, that's electronic. We can get checks. We can, you know, I mean, we get all forms of payment. They'll either be cashier's checks or electronic wire. We obviously prefer electronic wire because it's lower manpower time and it's more efficient and less likely to get messed up.
And my assumption that
but it's not mandated, you know, right. We don't have the ability to require it.
Yeah.
And so it does lead to the checks in the mail syndrome.
This is a classic example in my mind. Why would we just do that by regulation? Why haven't we done that? I mean, why haven't we done it 10 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, actually, I'm pretty sure there is a regulation that requires electronic payment if it amounts over a certain relatively modest amount.
Right.
Again, there are two reasons for this proposal. One, to remove any doubt that we have the authority to do that. Because, and this appears also in the reporting area, there's some question, since electronic payment and reporting is no longer a novelty, but up until a few years ago it was, whether the traditional language about requiring reports could be extended to electronic format without statutory authority. Again, this just to remove any question about that. And the second thing has having to do with formats, that we want to make sure that not only can electronic payment be required, but can be required in the specific form that the department believes is the most amenable to good administration.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we'll take a break until 15 minutes after the hour. Okay, Marcia, you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay, proceed.
Senator Huggins,
yes,
I asked our
what's your title? Today I'll play Administrative Services Director.
Administrative Services Director for Department of Revenue, Mr. Jerry Burnett, who is very, who was helpful to us in drafting the funding section of the bill, and you had asked a question about mechanically how the funding would work from year to year, as well as roughly what the dollar sums were, and since he was here, I wanted him to be able to address that question now.
For the record, my name's Jerry Burnett. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Alaska Department of Revenue. The question was on the tax credit fund, which is in, and how much money would go into it each year. I don't have the fiscal note in front of me, but I believe that the FYA funding or estimated revenue is approximately $1.9 billion. And so with 10%, that is actually a figure which is net of expected credit payments. So the funding into the fund in FY08, if we went through this and the appropriation is made by the legislature, would be approximately $200 million. That money, then whatever credits were paid in FY08 from the fund, which we think is between $125 and $150 million at this point, would come out of the fund in FY08. The rest of the money would roll forward, and then in FY09, 10% of the production tax revenue would go into the fund. The credits for 09 would be paid out of the fund. So it would, in high revenue years, build somewhat of a balance. When you get to a lower revenue year, it would have a balance in it carrying forward, which the legislature, if it got too big, could use for some other purpose, because it's not a dedicated fund. The legislature could appropriate it for another purpose. But it would allow for money to carry forward and roll in. One thing it does that would be helpful at this point, when you look at our fiscal note with revenue projections, it shows an amount going into the general fund that's actually lower than the amount that is expected to go into the general fund in that year, because with refundable credits, we're required to make then a general fund appropriation under the current system to pay for the refundable credits. Our revenue estimates are net of those credits. So right now it looks like we're projecting less revenue than we're actually expecting to get. And then the general fund actually carries a larger balance than we estimate, and then we take some out for an appropriation to pay credits. Creates a little bit of confusion, and at this point we have open-ended appropriations out of the general fund in 07. In 08 we had an appropriation which is limited at $25 million, which will require a supplemental, which will be made before we know how much credit.
Record. And we have two Great Alaskans with us. If you guys would put yourself on the record. Before you do that, however, could Miss Heather Brakes please stand up? Could you turn the camera on her? This is the wife of the Assistant Coach of the Year for the state of Alaska. Mr. A. Brakes is assistant. This is his wife, Heather. Heather, congratulations on Eddie's selection as the Assistant Coach of the Year. Okay, thank you. No speeches. Okay, Mr. Dickinson and Mr. Porter.
Thanks for the lights.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Dickinson, and I have roughly two presentations, basically one short one just to give some context, okay, and then a longer one which will essentially go through the legislation and look at highlights, lowlights, some issues that I think need to be raised. Basically in between those two.
I'm Steve Porter, a consultant to LBNA, and I will make also a kind of a shorter presentation, more at a higher level analysis of the bill and some of the issues associated with it. And then we'll both be available to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. And just for the record, and for what we got going on here in context for the next couple of days, tomorrow we're going to be back here at 9 a.m., and then we're going to take public testimony tomorrow evening, start at 6:15. So with that in mind, since we ran to almost 9 last night in a joint meeting, not later than, maybe a bit earlier, not later than 5 p.m., we're going to terminate this meeting so that we'll be fully prepared for the meeting starting at 9 tomorrow, because we can't work till 9 o'clock every night. And, of course, I think Monday Night Football is on tonight.
Oh, Jesus.
Hey, please, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have a 4 o'clock meeting over here with Senator Wagner's.
Okay. Yes, so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Dickinson. I am a consultant with LB&A. Those of you may recognize me. I do have a little bit of a history here. I was with the Tax Division, or the Department of Revenue, Alaska Department of Revenue, for 7 years, and then did a bunch of work on the original PPT and spent a lot of quality time with many of you in 2006 on that on those issues. So what I'd like to do is, in my first presentation, I'm basically looking at things from 30,000 feet. I'm actually not very comfortable doing that. I tend to, you know, I don't believe forests exist, although there are trees, and I like to deal with a specific tree. So in the light of keeping things going quickly, I'm going to actually skip through a couple of pieces of it. But one of the points I want to make, and this is something actually that Senator McGuire commented on a couple days ago, and I resonated with what she said. Several years ago, and I don't know if there's a pointer here. Yes, there is. For many years, we've been sitting, and this is a graph that I hope you've all seen before. It's number 4 in the slides. But this is our oil production. Basically, it takes us from 1965, at least this line here, which is where we are presently, and then projects it out about another 15 years. And I think it's a story we all know. The large orange area here is Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay at its height was producing 1.6 million barrels a day. It's currently down around something around 400 million barrels a day. All the other fields in our state brought us up at a high point to 2 million barrels a day back in 1988, and we've been on a declining slope since then, so we're now something around 700,000, about one-third of where we were 15 years ago. And during this period, everyone's focus was primarily on reinvestment, on the issue of decline. And when people talked about taxes, they were talking about issues about, for example, the economic limit factor, and the question was, if we change that, would that change the investment climate? And the general consensus, I guess, was it would. No one wanted to talk about that. And so for many years, you know, initially, for example, in 2003, some incentives were brought in for exploration. But fundamentally, I think everyone's thinking was dominated by the fact of that decline. And in some sense, the production tax, back in these days, the production tax was the largest source of revenue for the state, outpaced royalties. And by the time we came down here, because of the economic limit factor, the production tax was producing about half the revenue for the state that royalties were, and it was literally marching down towards a position where it would become an insignificant tax.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
The thing that I've never understood is we look at this decline here, and we had virtually no production tax, very little production class. It was declining every year. They expected it to decline every year. And there was, at least judging by this, there wasn't an incline. You would have thought that there would have been this tremendous rush of investment to come in since it was so, since the taxes were so low. But that wasn't happening.
Senator Wilkowski, there was investment occurring. And I think, again, what you need to look at, and I wish I had the slide with me, if you take out this decline in Prudhoe, you take out Prudhoe Bay, and you look at everything else, what you see, in fact, was other production was increasing. All the other skins here, and again, just, you know, Prudhoe and then its satellites, Kuparuk and its satellites, but then you've got all these other tiny fields, and all of those were getting new investment. The point is, they weren't elephants. They weren't other, you know, Prudhoe Bay was the largest field in the United in entire North America. So there was investment going on. Question is, was it enough? I used to cringe when our last governor talked about filling the pipeline again. But even with, you know, there were things happening that were bringing production up.
But that, where that investment was occurring, almost further supports the argument, because the investment was occurring in the places that didn't have the economic, that didn't have the 1% and 0% or 2% taxes that you had on Kuparuk and Prudhoe. The investments were occurring in places where the taxes were higher.
Senator, that is partially true and partially not true. The smallest fields that were developed had no tax. Places like right here where Alpine and North Star, they came on, in fact, with higher, with rates that were as high or higher than Prudhoe. So you typically, you certainly can make arguments about the overall rate and whether the investment would or would not have occurred had people been able to forecast what their tax rates were. And this is something I'm going to get into a little bit later. But what changed that atmosphere from looking at that point was another graph that I think you've all seen, which is the oil price.
Well, Mr. Dickinson, we saw your graph there. What I've taken away from your graph in the past is that the legacy fields were big finds. New finds are, as you said, they're not the elephants, and I've deducted from that one of the challenges we have in getting new explorations are there aren't any elephants, and that the cost of a discovery for an ant, I'll call it an ant, okay, is a high risk, and we're trying to balance that risk with finding the ant, a small amount of oil. Am I way off base, or am I kind of in the ballpark?
Actually, that's something I will. My plan on is to cover my testimony.
Okay, good. You're gonna do it? Fine.
But you're right. You're right along the right path.
Yeah. And just if I could, Mr. Chair. The other concept that I have never fully understood is looking at this chart. Our taxes are now higher, by IOGA's and other accounts, $1 billion higher. How can we expect to have investment increase? I mean, it doesn't seem to make sense with all the rhetoric that we're hearing, does it? We increased taxes $1 billion, and yet we're going to get more exploration than we had under ELF.
Can I go to the next slide, and we'll explain what's going on? What was happening at the same time that our production was declining, basically starting at a low point in 1999, what's changed the discussion is the absolute rise in oil prices. We're now at a point, nominally, of course, we're seeing prices in the $80, $90 range. Even in real terms now, it is higher than this peak over here, $35 back in 1980. So we are seeing an immense level of profitability in fields, and I think that gets to your issue. There are more dollars to go around. And if people invested expecting returns that would come from selling their product in the $30, $40, or $50 range, there is a good deal more on top of that that's being generated. This has changed the discussion, and I guess the observation I would make, and the sort of the sea change in the 7 years that I've been coming down and talking to folks about this, is we're no longer talking about the production tax as a tax. We're no longer talking about it as an imposition of the sovereign authority, something necessary to sort of part of the economic trade-offs that you make in our society or the sharing of risks and rewards in our society. We're now talking as if we're entering a bidding round. We're talking about leaving money on the table. We're talking about promoting ourselves to partners and wanting to share. And that may or may not be appropriate. You'll find some of my comments are based on, I sort of had, I think, a more old-fashioned tax hat on. But there's definitely a very different sense of what we're doing here than there was when we were focusing on the declining issues.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, you are hearing it from the legislature, but we're also hearing it from our experts. Every expert that I've heard from, Van Meurs, Johnston, Finizza, Gaffney-Klein, they've all said that we could have increased our taxes and we would still incur investment. They've all said that. That's not just us saying it.
No, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not disagreeing with you. Okay. All I'm trying to do is temper the conversation, is talking really about, if you will, finding a sweet spot where the tax is. But there are lots of other resources that our Constitution requires be managed for the common good, and nobody talks about leaving money on the table there. Have we extracted the last penny? Those kinds of conversations. So I'm just trying to say that there's been a real shift here in the last 7 years, and I'm commenting that that's what I saw. Like I said, I'm really trying to talk to you about where I'm seeing things from 50,000 feet, and maybe I'll be more comfortable when I get into talking about the words on the paper. I won't go through the next two slides. They're ones that are in every presentation I give, but they basically show the march down of one, the march up of the other, and just to do the math very quickly, you know, 1988, we were producing 2 million barrels a day with a market value of $15, so basically $30 million a day was being produced. Right now, we're only producing 700,000 barrels a day, but at $80, that's $56 million. And I think the point about a system that people need to design is, when they think about Alaska as a whole, it's good to have the $56 million, but what happens if you take the two lowest numbers from each of those and cross-multiply? You know, what would 700 million barrels a day at $15 be? And that would be $10 million a day. And I'm not making predictions about if and when there will be a price correction, how deep it will go. But I think any system needs to be robust enough to deal with those variations. So let me quickly move on. And this is a quotation that maybe I'm getting a little high flung here, but I think it's a very famous case. It's quoted a lot in tax circles because this is where Chief Justice Marshall articulated that the power to tax was the power to destroy. But one of the things that he also articulated, and I think this is something that is worth thinking about here, is he said, taxation is an absolute power, and like sovereign power of every description, it is trusted to the discretion of those who use it. And so again, I guess what I'm really trying to put on here is the hat that is thinking about tax as part of that economic compact made in a society between the rights and the responsibilities, and that's very different from entering into commercial ventures. And I'm not saying those two can't change the balance, which are, as you said, you're something that you hear different things in the legislature, you hear different things from consultants, but the notion is those are different ways of thinking about it, and as a society we perhaps are changing how we think about those pieces. I'm skipping around here, I'm trying to go quickly. Here's the cost story that you've all heard about. Cost down the $2 billion range, and then over 3 or 4 years, they go up to $4 billion. And the reason I've crossed out some of the lettering here, I was struck by these numbers. These are not, as you might think, the story we've heard about, you know, $2 billion in operating costs in the original fiscal note, and then a forecast rising to $4 billion. What those numbers are the Alaska General Fund expenses, the costs. And the reason I think that's relevant here is twofold. One of them is, when we talk about predictions of price, I'm guessing how many people, if you had gone back 4 years ago and said, what do you think the state of Alaska's costs will be in 4 years? Will they go up by 5%? Will they go up by 10%? Or will they double? And I'm guessing that very few people would have checked the box and said they were going to double. And so when we're talking about forward-looking information, and why the state is looking at a tax system and changing its tax system, I always think it's worthwhile looking at this graph and what has happened. You know, here's the spending from the days when the prices were low, and as prices rose, what happened to state spending? Again, I think it's all part of the perspective of looking at a longer thing of why we are changing the way we are thinking about these things, and I hope that's an illustration that is useful. When we're talking about information, this is one last thing I want to do, and I've actually been kind of upset about some of the things I've heard said over the last couple of days when I've been here. And I would like to walk through fiscal year 2007, and I would like to walk through what was some of the numbers.
Yeah, Mr. Dix, before you do that, I just want to note that Senator Dyson joined us. Welcome, Senator Dyson.
In 2007, when those of you who were here then left at the end of the regular session, you had passed a budget. And the Department of Revenue had said, you're going to have revenues from oil and gas of $3 billion. There's going to be another $400 million of non-oil and gas for a total budget of $3.4 billion. This isn't quite apples and apples. I had to go to a different document. We can reconcile this all if it becomes necessary. But the general fund appropriations were $3.2 billion, so there was an expected surplus of $200 million. And that was based, the 959 was based on the economic limit factor driven production tax. 2 months later, the end of August, the PPT had passed. The fiscal note said, in fiscal year 2007, there will be an additional $420 million, which will be the retroactive portions from 2006 that won't arrive until March of 2007, so it'll be counted as fiscal 2007 money. And fiscal year 2007 payments, that should say in fiscal year 2007, will be $923 million for a total increase of $1.3 billion. So you take the original estimate, you add $1.3 billion, you come up with $2.3 billion. So you're now looking at oil revenues of 4.3, non-oil, of course, didn't change, total revenues of $4.8 billion. Again, I'm not quite sure why the appropriation changed by 100,000, but spending was 3.4, so there was an expected surplus of $1.3 billion. So when a legislature looked at their responsibilities to take revenues and budget for them, that's what they did. So what happened? A year later, the total revenues that came in from the spring, and again, this is a spring forecast, so this was done about two months before the end of the fiscal year, so it's not finalized, but it's pretty close. Of the $2.3 billion that had been in the fiscal note for the special session, in fact, what had come in at $2.1 billion, so it's about $200 million off. Interestingly, as a percentage, that was actually one of the best of the projections that the Department of Revenue made. So let's just look at those. In the property tax, we had projected $36 million, have to shift gears. And in fact, there was a hearing on the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which drives the property tax, went much higher, 52. So that was a 42% increase. The income tax, prices being higher than people had anticipated, had gone up by 18%. On the oil and gas production tax, maybe you can say we got lucky. You know, our price forecast was off, our volume forecast was off, and our cost forecast was off. But the net effect was we actually came very close.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
How much is it projected to be off by next year?
By next, you mean current?